Okay, my turn to offer a few thoughts this evening, Saturday night, getting close to the end of the winter retreat, another 10 days or so to go. What's that like? Just check in with yourself. Looking forward to the ending, looking with dismay at the fact that it's coming to a close, fairly neutral. Just notice what it's like. When I was trying to think of what maybe to talk about a little bit this evening, number of things kept on floating through my head, but finally it landed on maybe a few thoughts about the use of thinking or thoughts, because we spend so much time immersed in the thought realm. So much of our lives are spent generating good thoughts or bad thoughts or experiencing random thoughts. We live in a conceptual world much of the time. There's the three sankharas, the three forms of formations or fabrications. Kaya sankhara, the bodily formation. Chitta sankhara, the mental formation. And Vachi sankhara, the verbal formation. And I think, as Ajahn Suchito often quips, it's we're, particularly in the Western world, we're very, very highly developed in the Vachi sankhara, the verbal formation. We are quite enamored with thinking and thoughts, the mental world, the conceptual world, the mental constructions of thinking, and sometimes skip over really even noticing the kaya sankhara, the bodily formation, and not being aware of how we get involved and are affected by the chitta sankhara, perceptions and feelings. But we somehow have learned the habit of being the victim of our moods through the manifestation of thinking. So it might be useful to spend a little bit of time just addressing this. We've addressed these topics throughout the winter retreat in different ways. So in some ways, this may be a bit of a summary to help consolidate some of the ways that we can reflect on this process and how to make it beneficial rather than obstructive, which is where often I think we find it. We find ourselves getting lost in the thinking realm, the thought realm that's under control of various difficult mind states or defiled mind states, obstructed mind states. And the Buddha does point this out and how it happens and what are some alternatives. It's a very comprehensive teaching that he offers, and dealing with these, dealing with the thought realms and the constructions that we create, the worlds that we live in, the patterns that we operate from. He spends quite a bit of time and instruction on, so it's really good to keep refreshing this as one of the teachings. I try and keep a little bit of a half an eye on what's happening out in the world, even while we're on retreat. And it's really amazing when you look at headlines, which is more or less where I try and limit my news intake to these days, so not to get too involved in deep stories, but just to know what's happening out there. But the way words are used, the way thoughts are used, words being the result of thinking, it all starts with the thinking process and then it moves into actual speech. But how powerful that faculty is, the speech faculty, and what's behind it, the thinking faculty, how strong and pervasive and how believable the thought world is, and how it affects our experience so strongly, for better or for worse. And the goal is to try and how to make it on the for better part and less on the for worse part. these mental speech patterns, these thought patterns. The Buddha has many different reference points to it in the teachings. There's two very well-known teachings where he addresses the thinking process and how to work with it. And if you've done any reading of the suttas, you've probably come across these two, both from the Majjhima Nikaya, one of them being two kinds of thought, which I think is number 19, Majjhima Nikaya 19, and then the one right after it, number 20, the removal of distracted thoughts. Both are very practical suttas, practical teachings to get your mind around, if you haven't already done that, and use them for contemplation. They're very useful, and they're very, very practical. The first one that I would mention would be the actual removal of distracted thoughts, because oftentimes that's what we find ourselves engaged with, distracting thoughts when we sit down to meditate or to have some quiet time. The thinking process just keeps running. That's its own nature. We can't really deny that, pretend that it's different or obliterate it or make it stop. If we get involved with trying to just stop thinking, we're going to probably be met up with a lot of frustration, because just that forceful effort in itself tends to reinforce the process. Eventually, sometimes the thinking process does slow down, and sometimes even stops in deeper states of meditative contemplation. But the nature of the intellect, which we all have, the nature of the intellect is to think. So we need to learn how to become the master rather than the victim of the process, and that means looking at it on a deeper level. So the Buddha says, well, here's five possibilities for when the mind is so distracted that it can't keep to its satipatthana object or its object of contemplation, like, for example, the breathing. It gets just completely pulled into the realm of concept thinking that's run by usually some sort of unskillful mind state, or at least a distracting mind state, whether it's something that pulls our interest or something that repels us or something that confuses us or causes us anxiety. Those are the underlying states that generate the thinking process. The thinking process is actually fairly high on the level of mental activity, high meaning on the surface, and the underlying states that determine where it is that we put our attention, and the thoughts that we think are usually at a bit of a deeper level. So oftentimes we find ourselves needing to start where our attention is being pulled, at the level of the thought itself. And the Buddha says, well, if you're involved with some sort of distracting thought, try the first attempt to see if you can come back to your focus of contemplation by substituting a thought, one thought for another thought, examining the quality of what thought it is that you're obsessed with or that is obsessing you or invading your peace of mind. What's the quality behind it? Substituting a different thought that's of an opposite quality. So if you're having a thought of sensuality, of desire, sense desire of some sort, try recognizing that and feeling that and substituting a counter thought that will balance it out, such as an asubha thought, a thought of the unattractiveness of something or the earthiness of something, something that draws your attention away from the alluring thought, the alluring fantasy, and into something that's more grounded or sobering, something that's just its opposite, has its opposite effect. See if that works. It's like substituting one for another, driving a small peg out of a hole with a larger peg, or a large peg with a small peg, just substituting one for the other. And that's what some of the trainings that we have are really good for, finding that substituting one perception for a counter perception. That doesn't work. Then the Buddha says, we'll try the next one in his list, which would be to see the danger of the thought. Go down into that thought and see, well, if you follow through on that, if you go seeking after that object or follow up on that urge to harm in some way by body or speech, or even just continuing to think about it in a negative way, continuing the argument in your head over and over and over again, and examine the danger in that. Where's it going to take you? Will it eventually lead to actually acting on it? Are you going to go and chew out somebody that you've been noshing on the thought process, using the thought process to get all upset about some past slight that maybe they encountered with you, something difficult, some harsh words? Will it result in your actually saying something you wish you hadn't said and then having to experience the regret of that, or maybe causing more damage? So examine the danger. Where's it gonna lead? Where will this take me? And do that consciously as a thinking process. So that's using a different kind of thought to counter the one that's causing all the difficulty. Seeing the danger, where will it go? If that doesn't stop it and get you to relinquish that particular train of thought, then even just try ignoring it, like sense restraint, pretending that it's just not there. Some people might say, oh, this is like really moving into heavy denial. But if you're doing it consciously, then it becomes a skillful form of suppression. It's sort of like, nope, not going there, just don't do it. And if you can do that mentally in an easeful way, then you've solved the problem. You haven't fallen for the trap, and you're not going to continue the papancha, the proliferation through constant reinforcement by unwise attention. So you're doing it consciously, but you're just turning away, not seeing it, not attending to it, not giving it, not fueling it with any gasoline to keep the fire going. So if just ignoring it doesn't work, then he offers a fourth suggestion, which is one that I like, because I think it actually starts to get down to more of the meat of the matter, starts to take you to below that level of conceptual thought, which is causing the problem, gets to the root of it. It's called seeing the formation of the thought formation itself. So you're going down to what are the qualities motivating its arising and your attention to it. Where does it come from on a deeper level? Is it coming from a feeling of lack, a feeling of want, a frustration for not having something or for having something that is unpleasant? And working towards actually what's the feeling tone of pleasant or unpleasant underneath it that's causing the rising up of this thought formation that we think is maybe going to ameliorate the situation or that will offer us some gratification in some way or some escape in some way. So it's going down into a deeper level of what's the motivating force, where is this being generated from, what are the feelings that are at the basis for it. So, and if that doesn't work and you're moving down the train tracks on a runaway train, and it's just so overwhelming that none of these ways of dealing with it are going to be helpful, then if it's moving you into the realm of dangerous behavior where you're really going to harm someone or harm yourself, then you have to take strong action. And the Buddha basically just says to take that thought formation, take that mental impetus and just crush it, stop it, say no. And some people again say, oh, this is, you know, severe repression. But if it's preventing something more dangerous from happening, then sometimes it takes that kind of strong word that it's just like if a little child is on the side of the road and busy traffic is going on and they run out into the middle of the road, you don't sit there and say, oh, you know, come back here, watch out for that car that's about to hit you. Come on, you know, it'll be more fun over on this side. You don't do that. You run out into the middle of the road, you grab the kid and you pull it back. So sometimes you have to do that with your thoughts. And I've done that before. Sometimes the momentum is strong and the mindfulness is weak, not so weak that you don't know what's going on, but you just realize where this is going. You say, no, don't go there. Not going there. Nope. Quit. Stop. And then you just go on to something else. So sometimes it takes a forceful measure like that. Again, it's useful to do that if it prevents you from going down a road that you will regret later on. So these are the five kinds of techniques that the Buddha offers for when you're beset with distraction, thoughts that just are taking you down the wrong road. And then the other sutta, the two kinds of thought, he basically, before he was fully enlightened and was practicing as the Bodhisatta, he said that it occurred to him to divide his thoughts into two different categories, skillful and unskillful thoughts, and just examine the effects. And so he, the three groups of thoughts that he was focusing on were the thoughts of sensuality, thoughts of ill will, and thoughts of cruelty as unskillful thoughts. And he saw that when those arose in his mind, that they led to his own harm or the harm of others or the harm of both, and that they were categories of thoughts that he wanted not to have to buy into and continue to repeat because of the suffering that it causes. So then he saw the other side, the skillful thoughts, their counter images of thoughts of renunciation, thoughts of non-ill will, or its positive counterpart, loving kindness, and thoughts of non-cruelty, or its positive counterpart, thoughts of compassion. So renunciation, kindness, compassion. And he decided it would be much more skillful to spend his time cultivating those positive ways of thinking. So he pursued that course, pursuing thoughts of simplicity, renunciation, relinquishment in the material realm, and generating thoughts of metta and karuna, compassion, kindness, and saw that they were very skillful states and produced a lot of good things, good results in his experience. And his summary reflection for the effect of those states of mind was something along the lines of whatever one thinks about and ponders about frequently becomes the nature of your mind. So he was recognizing the power of conceptual thought to help steer the quality of mind in a very skillful direction, which is, I think, the basis for cognitive therapy these days. That's a technique that's used to help recognize the thinking patterns and reprogram them in ways that aren't so afflictive. So I guess the Buddha, 2,500 years ago, had already discovered cognitive therapy, and it's encouraging us to use the thinking process, use the cognitive process to help condition the mind. It becomes the nature of your mind, whatever you put your attention on. And then he realized that even that, this is further down the line in his exploration of these kinds of thought, that even if he did that for long periods of time, certainly no harm in it and some benefits, but at some point it would, the effort that it takes to even think those skillful thoughts is wearying to the body, and when the body is tired, the mind is not. The mind is far from composed and collected. So he then is when he directed his mind to stilling the mind and quieting the mind, and seeing the benefits of that, possibly through, I would assume, through a technique like Anapanasati, something that's more body-based. But still, pointing to the positive effect of redirecting the thinking process in a skillful way. So using thought in a way that you're not the victim of the underlying tendencies that are trying to vie for your attention, that are trying to be in charge, the underlying tendencies of wanting and avoidance and aversion and confusion and anxiety and fear. Not letting those qualities be in charge, but letting these higher motivations be the basis for our thinking. But then really applying that to the thinking process. So these are just some basic methods that the Buddha talked about, how to deal with the various forms of thinking that we get ourselves wrapped up in. This also, he takes this process to the levels of greater realization on the spiritual path, the spiritual practice towards complete freedom. And a lot of the words that he uses in the teachings are incredibly skillful and beautiful words. The language itself that the Buddha uses to point out skillful states, skillful qualities, meditative techniques or meditative experiences, and all the way up to words that describe the results of the practice, the insight, the qualities of mind that come along the way to realization of truth, and then some of the descriptors of those deeper insights and realizations themselves. The words themselves that the Buddha has chosen are incredible. They're just so skillful and so direct and so pointing to the actual experience as much as can be done. There's always going to be limits, because when you start moving into the realm of freedom and release and ultimate truth, you're beyond the range of description. You're beyond the range of words. But the ones that do exist, the Buddha was able to pull out and put together in such ways that they actually can produce an effect, not just a thought or a concept or an abstraction, but they can actually lead to direct experience if you use them in the right way. So this is the power of Vachisankara, if it's used with intelligence and skill and diligence and exploration and the willingness to take it to the level of personal experience, not just theory. And our teachers in the tradition pick up on that and really try to encourage us to embody the use of these kinds of words or thoughts to take us to a direct experience, not just a conceptual appreciation. I have a few of my favorite ways, of course, and you've heard some of them throughout the past few months. You've heard other people who have given talks using some of them too, but I thought I'd just mention a few of them just as examples. And of course, all of these techniques, these ways, these words that you use to instruct yourself have to be personalized, because your own conditioning is deep in there, and could be that my words, my conditioning aren't the same as yours. So using these just as examples, but to go deeper into your own lexicon, your own vocabulary that will be your own Dhamma vocabulary that you can pull out and use as shortcuts to help channel you into an experience that will take you to greater freedom. So using your own set of words that you create to help guide you through the contemplative process. But again, I'll just offer a few that I've mentioned before that I've found very useful. And one is direct from Ajahn Suchito, who, particularly in the meditative process, and I find it very useful, particularly when I'm setting up my meditation for sitting down to practice or even on the walking path, to frame it with three reference words that he encourages the use of that create a specific quality of mind, a specific quality of experience that's very conducive to the contemplative process. And there are words that you've heard me use before of ground, space, and rhythm. So you can tell these are not very abstract words, but they're words that point to a direct experience, particularly as we're trying to embody the experience into mindfulness of the body. That particular level of satipatthana, that particular level of contemplation, I find is very responsive to being woken up by those three words, ground, space, rhythm. So that I start with the word ground, which I've conditioned my mind to go through a series of feeling the density, the heaviness, the earthiness of the body. Because this is a direct experience, this isn't a conceptual experience. The body has its grounded, earthy element. And if I start from either the bottom or the top of the body and scan through with the word ground, really looking for that experience of solidity, groundedness, heaviness in a dense way, that presence, it evokes the quality of presence, which is very useful in the contemplative process, to be here and now with the experience of the body. So ground, that's what ground, the word ground represents. So you can use that, scan through the body with that to bring the experience into the realm of the body rather than the realm of concept. It's using a concept to leave the conceptual realm and return to the actual bodily experience. And the same with space. It evokes almost the opposite quality of lightness and expansion, broadness, even boundlessness if you take it as far as it goes, but keeping it at the level of the body, you can explore that spatial element, that openness, that ease, that lightness, all throughout the body, whether it's in the actual physical structure, like the space within the skull or the mouth or the various channels that go through the body that can be filled with things if you think about it in that way, but also can create this experience of space and ease, even holding the earth element within that space. It's kind of a twist of perception, but that's what this is all about, is how to recondition our perceptions in a skillful way. And so if it works, it works. So that you can even, sometimes I even think, well, you can feel the solidity within the spaciousness, like a solid ball of some sort, like a baseball, but sitting within a hollow sphere of lightness that's holding that. So space and ground can coexist in the same contemplation. But also, you see, both words point towards an experience, not just a concept. And the same with rhythm. Once the focus is on the bodily experience, space and solidity, ground, then the mind can slowly settle with ease on the rhythm of the breathing, particularly if you focus on that quality of rhythm, not the breath itself, not the in and out sensation per se, although that's your basis, but the quality, the rhythmic quality of it. And that helps to draw your attention to not just one breath, but a series of breaths. And it helps pull the mind into the experience of very gentle in, out, in, out, and the whole body feeling it, the bodily experience of that continuity over time, and helps keep your attention focused in there, in that quality of breathing. So ground, space, rhythm, as a way of introducing a meditative structure. Those are using words to point to experience, keeping it simple so that you don't get involved with proliferation, mental proliferation, but returning to the experience of the body. You can also use words in relationship. I find it very useful to use them in relationship to the hindrances, their opposite qualities. We know what the five hindrances are, probably spent a fair amount of time contemplating the effects of the hindrances, which are present, which are absent, and their qualities. But to also reprogram our experience to a positive experience of the opposite quality. What happens when I'm free of the hindrances? When I'm free from sensuality, thoughts of sense desire, what are the words that I can evoke to say, well, what would it be like to be free from sense desire? Using that question, what would it be like? What would it be like to be free from sense desire? Contentment, fullness, replete, not wanting. And what do those words evoke? And you can let them sit for a while. So you're looking for an actual experience at a deeper level than just a thought. What does it feel like in the body to be replete, to be contented, not to want anything? Use those words to bring up that freedom from sense desire. Freedom from what it would feel like to be free from anger, are free from ill will, warm, easeful, spacious, kind. Gentle. Finding words, again, in your own vocabulary that evoke that experience, not just as a thought, but as something that drives you into the experience itself. The hindrance of drowsiness, what would it be like to be free from drowsiness? To not experience that, not to succumb to that hindrance. Fresh, alert, cool, alive, alert. What do those words evoke, or your own words? What do they evoke in terms of the energy in your body? Or that hindrance of restlessness, worry, anxiety, agitation. What would it be like to be free from that? Words that come up for me, be more like still, settled. Peace. Pointing directly to the experience of stillness. Last hindrance of doubt. What would it be like to be free from doubt? Secure. Unwavering, steady, confident. Just imagine what that would feel like inside. So take those qualities that are representative of the freedom from those mental hindrances, those affective hindrances, and take them all together and let them merge into one experience. And this is the mind that's wieldy, malleable, and able to be worked with and is a basis for deeper contemplation. Freedom from the hindrances is the basis for the development of samadhi. So you can use the Vachisankara, you can use this lexicon of your own devising to steer your mind to freedom from the hindrances. The last contemplation set of words that I find very, very useful are the words that the Buddha uses in that sutta statement, that phraseology that Lumpa is particularly familiar and fond of, the one of the calligraphy down in the day room. This is peaceful, this is sublime. And then the verbs are peaceful, well, the descriptors of peaceful and sublime themselves are lovely words just to say to yourself, peaceful, sublime. But I like to particularly focus also on the verbs in the next series of lines. That is the stilling of all formations. Stilling. The feeling, the imagery, the experience that invokes, stilling of all formations. All those inclinations towards action, formation, sankhara, still. The relinquishment of all acquisitions, all of the ways that we hold the khandhas, the forms, feelings, perceptions, mental formations and consciousness, divided knowing, how we relinquish those, process of relinquishment, as in the chanting that we did just earlier tonight, Chago Patinisago Mutti Analayo, giving up, relinquishment, freedom, non-attachment. What is the feeling that comes up in your experience just with the word relinquishment? Then on stronger language, the destruction of craving. Sometimes we need strong language to help get us into a particular experience or get us out of a particular experience, but the experience of craving, that constant movement of mind towards or away from something. Sometimes we need to take strong action. Destruction of craving. And then dispassion, just this no interest in going there, no need to go there, not aversive dispassion, but a very equanimous form of dispassion, just not interested in going there. Dispassion, ceasing, cessation, nirodha, non-arising, this perfect form of stillness that isn't moved, is imperturbable. Cessation, to stay with that. And nibbana, with all of its difficulties in translating, but all the many ways of trying to put a handle on what that experience is, pretty near impossible because it's really outside the realm of experience, but the cooling or the unbinding, in Ajahn Jeff's words, unraveling and disentangling. Yeah, the non-proliferating Nibbana. Very powerful words, all of those. Just to say them as a contemplative strategy, can repeat them. See the effect that it has on the heart, the power of these words to lead you somewhere. That it's all about where it takes you and using your contemplative abilities to reflect on where's skillful use of these words. Where will it take me? So I'll just leave it there for a few reflections on the power of vachisankara, power of thinking, and how it can be, we can be a victim to it if the defilements are in charge, but if we use it wisely, use it reflectively, and experiment with different ways of using these formations to see how it can establish the path and establish a direction for our life of contemplation so that it results in the completion of the path as we wish it to happen. So I'll leave that for reflection tonight.